Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of Nature Now at kptz.org. Well, hello, and welcome to this week's Nature Now program. I'm Nan Evans, I'm your host, and my guest today is Dr. Chris Kelly, oceanographer of the deep sea. Well, we've been talking with Chris on several programs, but let me reintroduce him quickly. Resident here in Port Townsend and who had a career working on the deep sea, and in some cases, the very deep sea. He has made hundreds of dives into the deep sea in submersibles and has guided probably just as many remote vehicles. Is that right, Chris?
I haven't done 100 submersible dives, but combined ROV and submersibles, it'd be over.
Anyway, it's just a gigantic number. And today is part three of a three-part series. And I want to briefly look back in part one, which aired here on KPTZ on April the 22nd of 2026. We talked about how the really intense and extraordinary characteristics of the habitats of the deep sea influence life. Particularly, we talked about the lack of sunshine and therefore the absence of plant life. We talked a little bit about how the absence of light creates really different behavior in animals, everything from finding mates to finding food. And we talked a little bit about the structure of food webs. Then in part two, which aired on May 20th of 2026, we delve further to think about the impact of the massive pressures that can be found in the deep sea and how the bodies of organisms are adapted to these pressures, sometimes thousands of times greater than what you find on the ocean surface. And we also talked a bit about the really strange and bizarre behavior of oxygen as you go deeper and deeper and deeper, where the bottom line there is dissolved oxygen decreases as you go deeper in the ocean to nearly nothing. And then at certain depths, it starts to rise again. We also talked a little bit about how to understand some of the ecosystems found on the different habitat types, from the abyssal plains to seamounts and the hot vent areas. So we're going to do part three today. Before we go into that, let's hear this week's mystery sound. Well, I'm trying to give you a hint, but I don't really know how to give you a hint to this sound. I can say that Chris Kelly sent it to me, and I'm never, ever likely to hear this sound, even as much as I would love to. So we'll come back to that at the end of the show. So, Chris, we've been talking about all kinds of marvelous, strange, interesting, and curious things. Let's talk a bit more about some of the really strange and sometimes even bizarre adaptations that animals living in the deep sea have. So pick one and go for it.
Okay, I will. Let's talk a little bit about current flow.
Okay.
And we talked about it a bit, I think, last time. Mm-hmm. But let's talk about a different element of it. And that is what's referred to as the benthic boundary layer. And by that, what it means is most of the deep sea current is sort of tidal driven currents. It's not sort of wind driven mm-hmm. near the surface, right? And so what are the types of things that can actually affect the rate of current flow down in the deep sea? Well, one of the things is the seafloor itself, because it's actually creating a certain amount of friction
sure.
of the water passing over the seafloor. And that effect extends up presumably around a meter or so above the seafloor, and you have to be above that to get the full prevailing current flow, but below that, the current is lower. Now, what does that mean for filtering animals?
You want to be in the higher layer.
You want to be in the higher layer because higher current flow means higher feeding efficiency, right? So some of these adaptations that we're seeing in the deep sea are animals attempting to get up above this boundary layer. So for example, some animals actually have unusual body forms that allow them to do this. When you think of a tunicate, what do you think of?
Okay, we need to sort of not get too scientific here. Okay. A tunicate is a very primitive chordate animal. Mm-hmm. It means it has the remnants of a spinal cord. And they're usually, when you see them in the low intertidal, they're just sort of vase-like blobs sometimes.
Sitting on the bottom.
Yeah, sitting on the bottom.
Sea squirts.
Sea squirts, yeah.
Right. Well, down in the deep sea, you've got tunicates on stalks. Because that's how they can get up above the boundary level. You don't see that in shallow water.
Well, and you mentioned earlier when we were talking about weird critters, the yellow lollipop sponges that you said were like 3 feet high above the bottom.
Right.
Now, the lollipop part.
Now, that doesn't mean all tunicates have stalks. No, of course, there are some benthic tunicates that are sitting on the bottom like vases. And same thing for sponges, plenty of those. But there are some species in those groups that actually feel the need to get higher. Mm-hmm. And so they're able to do this. Now, the reason I bring this up, too, is there's some other types of things that are going on, other types of stalked animals that you wouldn't typically find having a stalk in shallower waters. And one of the things I wanted to bring up, too, is that this also affects relationships between animals. So, for example, the deep sea has got a very large number of commensal relationships. And by that, it means that there's a very tight bond between one type of animal and another type of animal. And it may be that one type of animal is living on the other type of animal, which is the most common.
I think the word commensal comes, many things come from Latin, meaning something like shared table.
Right.
So they're not parasitic, they're not saprophytic, or they're just...
They live together.
They live together.
Right. And I use the term commensal, too, because I think most of the time these relationships are beneficial. Not always, but in many cases they're beneficial to both organisms.
Yeah, and certainly no harm.
Right. So to give you an idea, a lot of corals down there, first of all, they tend to be oriented horizontally like fans. They're not the type of corals you'd see in a coral reef, you know, where you have these big lobate corals or branched elkhorn corals or something like that. They're trying to get up toward the sun. The corals down there don't have that zooxanthellae, the algae that helps them acquire energy for them. So they have to catch everything to get their energy. And because of that, and these currents are moving horizontally across the seafloor, you tend to have a lot of fan-shaped corals or things like that. And these corals also want to, in many cases, try to grow up to they get above the benthic boundary layer. Or you'll find them on boulders or ledges, which are elevated above the abyssal seafloor, presumably to get higher current flow. But then there's a group of animals that use these corals to live on to get up off of the bottom. Same thing for sponges. They're very small crabs, brittle stars, shrimp, and they're all living in tight association with these corals and these sponges. And it gives them a way, because they're tiny, to get off of that low flow of water, presumably, to get further up into the water. The corals provide them some protection. They may help clean the corals, and they may even prevent some type of a predation from them. And it, you know, in some cases, the animal's looking for protection, but in other cases, the animal is clearly looking to essentially get higher up. And an example of these would be feather stars. You know, they're a type crinoid, where you'll see a lot of them sort of perched on top of corals. They're not doing anything to that coral. They're trying to use it to get up high, and they're filtering the seawater. So this benthic boundary layer is affecting a lot of relationships and some adaptations of animals. And these animals are all trying to get up into a higher current flow.
Okay, now I have kind of a naive question. How does an animal, let's say like a little crab, get settled into a coral?
This is not naive at all. Okay, first of all, the crabs are immune to any type of stinging from the coral.
Okay, that'll help, yep.
And the crab will get up there and probably provide some type of a service to the coral, to either removing mucus or, again, as I said, for some of the... Some types of crabs, they claim the coral as their own, and they won't let any other members get on that coral. So there's not an overabundance of these animals crawling around on them. They each have got their own little place. Brittle stars can do the same thing. They can inhibit, and to a certain extent, other types of animals from getting on the coral. Not always, but sometimes. Mm. On that. So, I mean, there's so many variations of what's going on. One of the most interesting parts in my mind is that there are certain relationships that are completely stable across the oceans. Basically, the same type of little squat lobster or crab or something that you find on this particular type of coral. If you go elsewhere, you go 1,000 miles away and you find that same coral, you'll see that same squat lobster. And you won't see that little squat lobster or shrimp or coral on a different type of coral. You'll only find it on that one type of coral. And you won't find usually that coral without its squat lobster or shrimp. It's always got to have that animal with it. And there's a perfect example of it is this weird kind of flower-shaped coral called Metallogorgia. It's a gorgonian, but it looks like a flower, and it has a very metallic sheen to the to the body. It's got a brittle star that lives in the center of it that is always the same species of brittle star, whether it's in the Pacific or whether it's in the Atlantic, and you don't see that coral without it, except when it's extremely young. Tiny. How do they find each other?
Yeah. I mean, I'm guessing the larva of the crab or the brittle star is in the water and it'll eventually go over a coral, but that seems pretty...
Dicey.
Dicey, yeah. That's kind of an unlikely thing. Anyway.
I'm wondering whether or not they sync their reproductive cycle somehow.
Oh, that could make some sense.
So when the coral releases the eggs and sperm or the planula larvae or whatever it is, because they do have different strategies, then these particular arthropods also release their larvae.
I want to ask you another question. When we were chatting before we started recording, you were talking about the spiral things. And I've certainly seen pictures and, I mean, even seen a little bit in the shallower water. They look like ropes that are just coiled in a spiral. Talk to us about that. What kind of adaptation is that?
Well, that's kind of perfect because it's for the exact same reason, currents, benthic currents, that you're seeing that type of a body shape. So basically what Nan is talking about is these wire corals that are very wiry. They're very thin stalk in many cases, but some of the bamboo corals can have a little bit thicker stalk, and they come up as a single stem or a stalk, if you will, and then they start forming this sort of spiral, like a spring going out from them. So why would a coral have that type of a shape? Well, one of the reasons it might is because it's in an environment where the current changes direction potentially frequently.
Sure.
And if you have this type of a shape and you're flexible, the current switches, you can flip your whole body around in the opposite orientation, okay? So that if the current is flowing from the east, it's first going to intersect where the stem of the coral is, and then the spiral part's going to be down current, right? Because
it's just right that way.
Then the current switches and the coral flips around the other way so that the spiral part's now on the opposite side. And the spiral part itself is a way of exposing as many of the coral polyps, the little feeding parts of the coral, to the water and maximizes feeding efficiency. Plus, if the current's high, the actual spiral opens up like a spring. So sometimes you see these things and there's hardly any spiral to them in a high current.
It's like a long rope or something.
It's not a long rope. And then lower currents, it kind of coil together.
So it's obviously got a soft skeleton. It's something that's holding it together other than the
tissue itself.
Yeah.
Right. But I mean, it's remarkable when you can see this. And I happened to see this happen once when I was down on the bottom and we were eating lunch, and we happened to be eating lunch during a current change. there, and you see all of these wire corals. We're in a field of them. They're all facing one way, and then you look up after you're eating your sandwich, and 10 minutes later, they're all facing the other way.
Wow, interesting. So let's do some other interesting things you observed down there. I'm thinking we sort of talked about things that are adaptations for feeding. What are some other interesting adaptations related to feeding?
Well, there is a type of fish, and its scientific name is Ipnops.
And okay.
it's in a group that are called the tripod fishes. And what's weird about this fish is that other members of that group have these tiny little eyes. Right? Why? I don't really know why they have these eyes. These are really deep. They're usually like thousands of meters below the surface, right? This guy, instead of having tiny little eyes, he has these big oval discs on the top of his head where the eyes would be, and they're photoreceptive, and they're sort of almost a bioluminescent green. And I gather they're sensitive enough to pick up bioluminescing organisms or something like that. So they're
like
not
a
really...
tiny bit of light down there.
Yeah, tiny bit of light.
From bioluminescence.
But they're not eyes. He can't form an image, but he can detect something going by that would allow him to ambush whatever's generating that light. I assume that's what they're for.
Seems a reasonable assumption until we know more, you know?
Yeah.
You
know? So it's like you took somebody's eyeballs out, if you'll pardon the sort of gross analogy, but you took his eyeballs out and then you painted the inside of the eye socket with sort of a green bioluminescent paint. And that's what these optical structures look like in that fish.
Well, and you also mentioned previously something you called the Venus flytrap anemone.
Yes.
So what's that?
Okay. Well, most people know what a Venus flytrap plant is, where it's got this open kind of structure with little
sort of
filaments on the edge.
Round or oval or disc-like. And it's got
a little pool of sticky stuff.
Right.
And the insect goes into it and goes into the center of it, and then the plant closes the structure and it eats the insect. Okay. Well, there are anemones down in the deep water that do the exact same thing, in that they open up kind of the round disc, the feeding disc with the tentacles around it. They kind of can bend them a bit, but they look like they're a Venus flytrap plant, but they're sitting on the bottom doing the same thing. An animal comes in, there's no sticky substance or anything for it to get stuck in, but presumably the anemone is detecting the water motion.
Mm-hmm. And it's got the stinging cells.
It's got the stinging cells, but then it just closes right up. And just like the plant does, catches the little crustacean or whatever triggered
it. That's fascinating, thinking about convergent evolution.
Yep.
You know, it's the same mechanism, it looks similar, but in a plant and
worked
an anemone.
In plants. Yeah. Why not? Why not work in anemones?
Let me see. I think you also mentioned something. I guess I'm stuck in the anemone world. Because I like anemones.
Well, here's one for you. It's anemones still. Tube anemones. Okay, so this is a strange type of anemone that doesn't just glue itself to rocks like most people see anemones here along our shores. Instead, this anemone that lives in the sediment, and it secretes a tube, of sort of a chitinous type of a tube. And whenever it's threatened, it retracts down into this little tube. The tube sticks up off the bottom a little bit. And then the anemone will come out of the tube when everything's safe, and it'll be doing its little filtering type of thing, trying to catch something. And then it'll zip down into the tube when it feels threatened. Well, we came across a gigantic form of this. This is a tube anemone. But it was big, and it did not live in a tube. It was sitting on a rock.
How big?
I would say that the tentacles and the base of it were at least a foot or more.
So that's a big.
It's big.
Dinner plate size. Okay.
Right, and the tentacles were long. Those are maybe 6 inches long plus, or even more than that. And what was weird about it is you can tell by the structure of the tentacle that it's in this group, Cerianthereans, which are tube anemones. You can tell that it's in that group, but it's not in the sand the way most of them are. And so we decided to collect this specimen that was unusual because nobody had ever seen it before. We're in the ROV, ROV is down and we're manning it from the ship, but the ROV gets its manipulator arm out and it goes to collect this thing. And darned if the tube anemone didn't swim off.
The notion of anemone swimming is, really?
It uses its tentacles in some wavy type of a way to swim away.
Wow.
And we were stunned.
I'll bet. And I'll bet it's one of many things that probably stun you as you're looking around down there.
But why would it have this?
Why would it do that?
Well, it didn't have a tube. It couldn't retract down
into it's avoiding
predation
from something.
Yeah.
You know so much and has such a deep experience. And I find it so amazingly fascinating and curious and, yes, indeed, weird. We've not got a lot of time left. And other than the deep sea being fascinating and the curiosity of just the kinds of creatures that live there, I want to ask the basic question of why care? Are there benefits to humans? I guess that's the way humans think about it. Are there benefits to humans of protecting this, of knowing more and of protecting these habitats?
Right. Well, the deep sea, one of the most important functions of the deep sea is to serve as a carbon sink, which means that it sequesters atmospheric CO2. And that's via organisms settling out and dying and becoming part of the abyssal ooze in the bottom and things like that. There's also some physical properties, not just biological properties.
So that the carbon sink stuff would be really important in the context of climate.
Exactly.
Right.
We're entering that. So, but we're getting a benefit from having a deep sea as part of our planet.
Okay.
Then the other thing is there are both physical and biological products or potential products that are down in the deep sea that are starting to interest various countries. And in particular, the one that's getting a lot of attention right now is deep sea mining.
Mm-hmm.
And this is simply because there's a lot of minerals in seawater that over a very long period of time, they precipitate out and start coating rocks or forming nodules on the seafloor.
So this is the manganese nodule or manganese crust that people have been talking about.
That's correct.
For some time, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, until recently, the technology to try to harvest any of these minerals or not harvest, but to mine any of these minerals has eluded us because of the difficulties of working in the deep sea, the pressure and the distance and so forth, what has to be done to collect any of this material. The problem is that there's a lot of animals that rely on this material that live in these habitats that could be seriously disturbed by mining activities.
And there is a sense of destroying what we don't understand or don't know.
We don't know it yet.
Yeah.
And yet we're proceeding full steam ahead toward potentially acquiring these minerals.
Now, my understanding is that I think initially of the manganese. Are there other really important minerals associated with that or similar kinds of crusts of other minerals?
Yes, we call them manganese nodules because manganese is one of the dominant minerals in there, but they're typically loaded with things like iron, cobalt, copper. There are rare earth elements.
All the things that are really important to modern technical life.
That's correct. And industry as well. And so it's a huge reservoir on the deep sea of these minerals. But once you remove the minerals off of the surface, you're destroying everything off of the surface that live there. Plus, don't expect those minerals to reappear like a forest that you forested. You can't replant it. You're talking about a process that takes millions of years.
So, and you also mentioned some biological benefits.
Right.
Give me a couple examples there.
Well, I'll give you one example, and this is a particular type of enzyme that's used in a process for genetics and in amplifying genetic samples. And it's the actual process is called PCR, or polymerase chain reaction. I think it's reaction or reagent. But anyway, basically, there is an enzyme that facilitates that whole process. And how does that work? Where in order to denature a DNA molecule so that you can replicate and make
get
a lot more
DNA
of it,
to really test.
Yeah, you have to unspool the two parts of the DNA molecule, and you do that with heat. And if you have an enzyme that you want then to make the copies on each of the strands, it has to be able to withstand that type of heat to open up the DNA. Well, as it turns out, in these hydrothermal vents, these enzymes are there. They're in animals that have evolved to live in these higher temperatures, and their enzymes have to tolerate it in order for them to even survive.
Who knew?
Who knew? And so, you know, the sort of the classic example is the O.J. Simpson blood spot on the fence or something like that, a minuscule amount of blood. You know, how can you possibly even test this dried little droplet? Well, you get a tiny little amount of it, and then you put it through this PCR process with these enzymes, and the next thing you know, you have enough to actually determine whose blood it is.
That just seems to me that's kind of one thing that has developed relatively recently, and there must be hosts of other possibilities that we just have no clue about.
Yeah, exactly. They're looking at various types of sponges and corals for antibiotic and anti-cancer properties right now. There are so many animals we know nothing about that it's potentially a gold mine of biopharmaceuticals down there.
I think we need to listen to that mystery sound. Again, this was something that Chris actually sent to me, so let's hear it again. Imagine yourself diving in a deep water submersible, and you and your shipmates are very, very quiet. Those were the sounds you would hear, the sounds of the submersible. The recording was made by Chris Kelly from inside a submersible that was on a dive to over 1,000 feet below the ocean surface. The whining sound, he tells me, is the pilot actually operating the submersible and, you know, maneuvering it around. The clicking is the sound of the underwater acoustic positioning system. There's an acronym for that, but that's its navigation thing. And then there's the louder click, Chris says, is the signal that's coming from the mothership, the ship on the surface, keeping track of where you are, right?
Yes.
So that is, yes. And I said, I've never heard it, never expect to hear it, and I doubt anybody in the audience either. But it was fascinating just to kind of pretend for a minute that we were in a submersible. Well, thanks, Chris. This has been a fascinating set of conversations. We will have to do it again and talk more because there are lots more topics to talk about. And we barely touched on seamounts, your favorite habitat down there. To listeners, thank you oh so much for listening. And if you have missed a broadcast version of Nature Now or want to rehear something, remember you can find podcasts on the KPTZ website, or you can use the podcast app on a smartphone or a computer, because we are on several of the podcast applications. Just search for Nature Now and you can access lots of past and current episodes. We also, of course, have a Instagram site, and we've got some pictures posted on that site of some of the critters that Chris has seen. And so I just have to say thank you. Thank you so very much for this really fascinating conversation.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me. I love to talk about this.
Yeah, I can tell.
It's wonderful. I really, really appreciate it.
So, and to listeners, thanks again for listening. And thanks to our sound engineer and editor, Nora Petrich.